Okay, great. It's great to be here, and I think it's really exciting to talk to, of course, lots of neurobiologists who think about mapping in different ways, but also the physicists. As you'll see, I work with a bunch of physicists who I have to explain topographic mapping to all the time, and I'll show you our great interactions with physicists who are waiting for the new collider to be built, and we're looking for a hobby, basically. Okay, so Greg already introduced all of this stuff, but you know, our brain is organized, and one of the ways the brain is organized is, right, it's regionalized. So you have different cortical areas for touch, for motor activity, and for vision and smell, and it's all regionalized. But somehow, right, and each of these senses, each of our senses is processed in parallel. So we have specific receptors to detect these different modalities, and they all go to primary areas in the cortex or reflexive areas in the subcortical areas. But eventually, somehow, it all gets bound together, right? And that's what I'll loosely call consciousness, all right? And I'm going to get to this, and it's not just a big slide. We're going to talk about consciousness or how different modalities map together at the end of this talk, if we're still awake. All right, and so, right, how's the brain wired up? Greg went through this. It could be genes that help wire up the brain, which, you know, some transcription factors, example, are brain patterning molecules. It tells visual cortex to be in the posterior part and somatosensory in the medial part. Things like that. So the different transcription factors or patterning molecules set up the basic regionalization of the brain. And then there are different axon guidance cues that tell the connections where to go and who to form. And then there's this whole other thing besides genes, neural activity, which I'll loosely call nurture. And you know, those are experience-driven activity, which is proper nurture, or what I'll talk about is improper nurture, spontaneous neural activity. But the same idea is that the pattern of action potentials by a neuron can help dictate if it performs synapses, and it can help tell a neuron if it's in the right place or the wrong place.
Is it known from the genomics community how many brain patterning molecules there are?
Well, I don't think it's known exactly, but there's dozens and dozens.
Not thousands.
But not thousands. Not thousands. Am I on the right order of magnitude?
I'm wrong.
Yeah, so to physicists, I'm learning, I just need to speak within one order of magnitude.
Unless you may have hundreds of thousands of D-scams or coherence.
Yeah. They're not really brain patterning molecules, D-scams. It depends how you think about it. But right, so we'll get into this. But there's hundreds to thousands, let's say that, brain patterning molecules. And axon guidance molecules, there's maybe half a dozen families of known axon guidance molecules, and each family member may have multiple subtypes, like the Fs and Ephrins we talked about. Okay, and of course, experiences, you know, there's tons of different kinds of experiences. All right. And so what's the other point? These two mechanisms, we all sort of feel that the way we behave is a product of our genes and our environment, right? And what I'm going to get to, or the idea here, is that, you know, there's definitely going to be both of these mechanisms are involved, but where you look, the ratio of these differences, even between different animals, the ratios may be different, or in the different structures in the same brain. Okay, you'll see when I say that. Greg already talked about, everybody was here for Greg's talk, so everybody knows topographic maps. That with that basic, I'll simplify it, and this is what Greg did. Neuron-neuron relationships in brain structure A, they may project long distances, fasciculate in nerves, but when they get to their target areas, they'll fan out and maintain their neighbor-neighbor relationships in the target area. So that's what I'm referring to, is topography. Greg talked about it, and you know, here's pictures. We have a body map on our motor and somatosensory cortex, where literally if you start touching your surface of your body, neurons will fire in the same order across the cortex. And in the visual system, you know, we take in the outside world, and it gets flipped over by the lens, gets projected onto our retina, and literally the same order is projected as we go from brain structure to visual brain structure to brain structure. Okay? Right, and so this is what Greg's problem is, and the problem of the field, how does a neuron know where it is and know where to go? Okay, that's what we're trying to solve here in our lab. And Greg went through these, but I think I'll talk about it just to keep it a little bit, is that there's sort of three. The way I see it, there are three different mechanisms you could accomplish. A neuron can know where it is and know where to go. One is every neuron could have a different marker on it, a different D-scam splice homolog, for instance. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of neurons in the retina, but they could each, in theory, get a different specific label. And they go in the target, and they would have their cognate label, so it might be a receptor and a ligand. And when they find the right ligand, they synapse it. Okay, so like I said, this would take a bunch of different individual labels. So that's one problem with this idea. And the other problem is when a neuron, an axon, neuron projects its axon in the target, it would have to search hundreds of thousands of neurons to find its particular labels, because there's no order between the different labels. There's no meaning in the order of the labels.
Plus, you would have an exponentially complicated system of labels, right?
Right. It's very, but just because something's complicated doesn't mean it couldn't be true, I guess. And in flies, there's some examples where it is complicated. Individual labels may have some unique identities. All right. And then Greg talked about the Sperry hypothesis, positional identities by gradients. So instead of the individual labels, you have labels that are expressed differentially. So there's a unique amount of expression in each label. And they would find their target, their ligand might be, would be graded too. And in this example, which is opposite of what is true, the high would map to high, medium to medium, and low to low. So in this case, this idea gets rid of two problems with this theory. One is you don't need as many different labels. You just need a way to express them differentially. And then when an axon gets in the target, since it could sense the label, since they all have the same receptor, they can go into the target and they just have to decide if they like it to go towards it or dislike it to go away from it and find their position. So it seems like it's a simpler way to find your target, sort of just by smelling up or down a particular gradient rather than have to search for a specific label. And then the third idea is that positional identity can be determined by your neighbor relationships, right? So as Greg talked about a little bit, neurons that are near each other tend to fire action potentials at the same time of each other. These are depicted as spike trains here. And they'll be quiet. As importantly, I think, they'll be quiet at the same time as each other. Neurons that are further apart from each other would fire not at the same time, so they'd be non-correlated, okay?
The trouble with gradients is accuracy.
So one trouble with gradients would be accuracy. How do you give a unique identity, really, to every neuron? And then the other thing...
theoretically, conceptually, people know how to... people know what the resolution of...
I need a theorist.
I'm going to talk about a gradient tomorrow, where basically a two-fold difference in a regulatory substance in terms of a naive cell will become a neuron or a muscle. It's a very, crude level of cellular identity. It's not the fine-tuning you see here.
Right. And I think maybe the other idea would be local disturbances in the gradients. If you combine this with another, it can be swamped out, like Greg said, by these other mechanisms potentially. So it helps maybe smooth the gradients or give more precision.
One of the things that you have in these kinds of systems, is that very often there's a long period of time for the cell to decide. So it's not like it's got to make a decision right away. And then, what Dave will talk about, what I talked about, it's like a week, of sampling, trial and error, figuring it out before the thing gets sort of fixed. So, if there's not great accuracy over a short interval of time, that can actually, by various mechanisms, be optimized over a longer period.
Of course, errors are made because the system refines itself to experience.
Right. Or
we'll see. It doesn't have to be super accurate to start with, right?
Right. I'll show you hard data to show. Basically, I'm going to show you examples where you take away this, take away that, ask what happens, take away both, ask what happens, stuff like that. So what's my analogy would be, right, if we all had to move to another room and we wanted to keep everybody sitting where they were, I could go put a symbol in the new room and give you all a symbol and you'd match it up. I could give you an aisle and row number and then you could find your new seat just by going down the aisle and row number. Or the bottom example, you could all hold hands, walk to the next room and sit down and you'd maintain your relationships. Right, the problem with this alone is you all might be sitting, you'd still maintain relationships, but you might not be facing the board, right, if you just held hands. So you need an orientation cue if you just had activity alone. Okay? Do you guys agree or follow that reasoning?
There are four possible variations.
Sure. Well, around one axis.
Right.
So this alone wouldn't be necessarily enough. Okay, we do this in mice. I'll show you a bunch of experiments. We like mice because we can knock out genes, relatively easily, or ectopically express genes, as Greg showed so elegantly. They have many of the same visual areas as a human, all the primary same visual areas. As Greg said, they're very accessible to manipulation, the visual system especially. not essential for viability. A blind mouse can live in a cage, so it's nice to think that we could screw up vision and we can still study the mice. It's hard to study dead mice. Right, and it's a long-standing model to be used both by theorists and experimentalists. And just to remind people, the visual system has a couple different streams. You know, we have the retina, which, you know, is the two-dimensional sheet of cells that has your nasal, temporal, and dorsal ventral axes, as Greg said. It projects to multiple areas, okay? So the retina has direct projections to the superior colliculus and the midbrain. This is what Greg was focusing on. And this is important for reflexive head, neck, and eye movements in response to stimuli. So if you're subconsciously tracking an object, that's goes through your superior colliculus. You're wanting to put things in the middle of your visual field subconsciously. This is a lot of it starts here in the superior colliculus. You also have a conscious visual pathway which goes through a thalamic intermediate called the LGN, which is interesting because it's a three-dimensional structure. So you're going from a two-dimensional sheet of cells to a three-dimensional structure buried in the thalamus, which then projects back to the visual cortex, back to a two-dimensional sheet of cells, and the visual or primary visual cortex where a conscious visual stream starts to take place. So, you know, you figure out what the object is and whether you should get out of the way of it, you know, or where it is.
It's pretty radical to say that that's conscious mode.
It's probably a simplification. True. I think it's not super radical to say this is not subconscious.
And this is based on human report experiments.
Lesion studies and things. And I think, I don't know if anybody else, I actually haven't done any behavior studies. But I guess let's keep it simple. There are different visual behaviors. And then what I will talk to you about at the end is the visual cortex projects to the superior colliculus, and the idea is this keeps everybody in register. Okay. Okay, so here's this gene family that Greg talked about. It's a huge family of receptor tyrosine kinases called Fs. There's A and B classes clustered by sequence similarity. Their ligands are called efferins. There's A and B class efferins. They're really neat molecules in a number of contexts. Fs are receptor tyrosine kinases, so when their ligand binds them, it triggers an enzymatic activity which can modify proteins downstream, and one of the things they do is leads to depolymerization of actin and growth cone collapse. The ligands, though, are membrane-bound, and especially it's been shown in the B ligands. When a B receptor binds a B ligand, they're signaling in the ligand-bearing cell, too. Okay? So even though the ligands don't have a tyrosine kinase domain, they have domains that get phosphorylated upon receptor binding. And it sets up docking proteins and enzymatic activities. With the A ligands, they're GPI linked to the membrane, so they have no intracellular domain. But it is known that the efferin A ligand receiving cell can signal or receive a signal from the receptor binding. And I draw question marks there because it would implies that you need some protein to be a co-receptor to actually reach inside the cell. And I've seen manuscripts and abstracts that suggest they know what these question marks are, but I personally don't.
Are these conservative overall?
You rejected.
But I rejected those papers.
Conservative overall with animals and plants? These
okay, right. So these receptors, they're pretty cool. So, It's not. I'm not a reviewer. So these are humans down to zebrafish and Ciona, as we'll learn. Which is a, what do we call a Ciona?
It's a
model chordate.
A model chordate, right.
Very simple chordate.
It's something grows on a tunicate, right? On a rock? In a sea tunicate?
Sessile.
As adults.
Anyway.
Tadpoles.
They're conserved, yeah, all the way, but even flies and worms have them, okay? So that's, but yeast don't, okay? The gradients and expression patterns are remarkably similar throughout evolution, too. Although the names of the particular members may change, everything I'm going to show you about gradients has been shown in the human, as well as the mouse and the zebrafish.
Although the thing that is interesting about this family relative to every other receptor PTK family is that it's radiated twice additionally. So that's why it's so big. Every other RTK, you have basically gone through two rounds of depth duplication from Drosophila typically. So you have four, or if you've lost some genes, you have three or two. But this family essentially has 16 if you lost one, so it's the only one that's like that.
So, and what I'm going to show you is there's a lot of redundancy in these things too. So any A ligand can in vitro activate any A receptor, tyrosine kinase activity, and B to B, with a few exceptions. And a lot of these A ligands are expressed, or a lot of the different members are expressed in overlapping patterns. So what I'm going to show you today is that EphrinA2, A5, and EphrinA3 are all expressed in similar areas, and I'm going to show you what happens when you remove all three of them, okay, because of this redundancy issue, which makes genetics complicated. All right, so let's summarize some facts I just told you. So they're cell-cell contact-dependent signaling molecules capable of bidirectional signaling. Okay, I haven't shown you this, did I? The complementary gradients of expression along the nasal temporal maxing axis in each visual area. Greg showed you this with the collicular projection. EphrinAs are... I'll go through slides, I think. And EphrinAs are repellent molecules. They also may act as attractants in other contexts, and I'll talk about models. And remember, EphrinAs can also act as receptors for FA bearing. Lots of redundancy. Okay, so here's what I mean by gradients, and these are what Greg was talking about, and you'll see how hard it is to determine them unless you're very careful and do radioactive in situs like Greg's lab did. So these are snapshots of RNA expression in the developing mouse brain at the different visual areas. And so in this case, this is the developing retina. These are sections through the eye in the horizontal plane. So temporal retina is on top, nasal retina on the other, and there's this here. This is the lens. This innermost cells are the ganglion cells. They project out to the brain. Okay, they're the axons that project out. And you can see this purple signal is where we detect the mRNA expression. In this case, this is for one of the receptors, FA5. And you see it's stronger on the temporal side and graded down lower to nasal. And Greg's calculated the slopes of these gradients. And what did he say? Threefold difference, approximately. Now, what Greg didn't talk about... What Greg did is he did experiments similar to this, only with a radioactive probe, so there was no... Okay, so you take a section of the mouse eye, and we have an antisense probe that detects the messenger RNA. This probe has incorporated into it a nucleotide that's modified, which then an antibody recognizes as the modified nucleotide. The antibody is hooked up to an enzymatic reaction, an alkaline phosphatase reaction, so you're getting a purple precipitate so it's indirectly measuring where the RNA was. And so the absolute levels, we're going to saturation, so you can trust that there's a difference. The slope, I don't want to, this slide isn't designed to tell us what the slope of the gradient is.
The problem with this report, all these enzymatic reports, is that they're extraordinarily non-linear. What this gives you is just a kind of gestalt impression.
That there's differences here as you go around to there. So one end to the other end is the extreme differences. And this little bit of temporal retina always goes down again. And we can talk about this some other time, but it has to do with binocular species. So the more binocular species is, this peak of expression moves, and in a human would be right down the middle. It'd be high central to low periphery. And this has to do with the way the eyes, since the eyes project to both sides of the brain, how they interact with each other.
So just to emphasize, so I sort of skipped over all that, but that's a very important point relative to you and I are mice. So mice, we can basically, and David can probably talk about this, because their eyes are on the side of their head, almost all the axons cross to the other side. And you only have like 95% of the axons cross over. So that's why this region is small in the mouse. So you can just view it as sort of going around. But he's totally right. If you do the same in situ in a human, which has a big chunk of the retina going to the other side, the shape of that gradient would be very different. It wouldn't be smoothly rising like you see here.
Right. And so the other point is that I want to make here is in the retina and everywhere we'll talk about the ligand, in this case it's EphrinA5, one of the ligands, is expressed in a complementary pattern. So low nasal, high nasal, receptor high temporal, ligand lower temporal. So there are complementary gradients within the retina. Okay. And here's sections, here in this case a coronal section through the brain to reveal the LGN, which is this thalamic target. And you see high Ephrin ligands here, and it goes lower along this axis. And remember, the LGN is a three-dimensional thing, and this is basically the nasal temporal mapping axis. Okay, and the receptor, FA7 in this case, is expressed in the complementary pattern. Okay, so if you're a neuron, you're expressing high ligand and low receptor. Although we can't get neuron by neuron, I can't talk about it in single neuron terms accurately.
Sorry.
So the third dimension is not in the LGN is not relevant to this map.
Well, it's complicated, right? So how do you map a two-dimensional thing into three dimensions? I could go on a long ways, yeah, about how to try to explain that. And there is a third dimension. I think what the third dimension really is these retinal ganglion cells here, they're not all the same. They're different subclasses of retinal ganglion cells. There's on cells and off cells, and they respond to different stimuli. So there's really a bunch of parallel streams of information coming out. And what I think is that third dimension is the individual things mapping in columns now in the LGN and things.
So each one of the layers that will reproduce this particular organization in terms of spatial.
Right. Yeah, each one of them would be topographically mapped and maybe have the same rules.
Okay.
Does that mean I was too long on the same slide? Okay, so just to finish off, here's the LGN. The colliculus, it's the same idea. Here's the posterior anterior gradient. It's hard to see. Here's the receptor. Here's the ligand. High posterior to low anterior, darker here to lighter. And the receptor is darker here than lighter. And so it fills in. And it's true in the cortex as well. So you have gradients. The point is you have complementary gradients of these guys in every visual area. Although the cortex is harder because we don't have good marker. It's not morphologically distinct for V1. But we can go into that later. Here's the idea of repellent molecules, a simple idea. So here's a stripe assay, what we call a stripe assay. Challenge retinal explants in vitro. So we take out a chunk of the temporal, which is high receptor, or nasal, which is low receptor. Have them grow out axons and allow them to choose between stripes, where the red stripes are membranes that have been harvested from cells that were transfected with an efferent. Yeah, the red stripes. And then we add a little fluorescent beads into the membrane prep and lay them down via mask onto a membrane. And then we fill in the holes with non-transfected membranes. And if the neurons express high receptor, they don't like the efferents. They grow in between the stripes. If they have low receptor, they don't care. Okay, so this is the idea. And people have tried to mimic Greg's idea. You could change the concentration of the efferent and says, where do we get the switch from like to dislike? And, you know, it's hard experiment to do. But that would be one nice ideal way. Or instead of all or none stripes, to have axons grow into gradients and ask where do they stop growing and things like that. So there's a whole sort of field of in vitro work which is help is designed to understand what is the important part of a gradient, at least in the absence of a postsynaptic target. But in our case, we just want to say they're repellent molecules.
That's the most useful thing.
Yeah, right. Okay, so now if I put all this, what I just told you together, here's one idea. If you have a temporal axon, you have high receptor. And in the LGN, that would make you map to low ligand, because you don't like ligand. If you have low ligand, you're expressing high receptor. High receptor would make you want to go to low ligand in the cortex. If you have low ligand in the cortex, you would have high receptor, and then you'd map to low ligand. And so this is the idea by using these reciprocal, one idea, it's not proven, that reciprocal gradients can be transferred and help keep everything fluid as you map from visual structure to visual structure. And so you can imagine you could evolve a whole new visual area and keep it mapped normally if you could just have that area have counter gradients.
How do you rationalize that also the ligand is in the retina? That's also a
projection. Okay, so why the ligand in the retina? Right, so in that case, this fact doesn't work with the transfer unless, remember, the ganglion cell layer aren't the they're receiving information from inner neurons in the retina, and it could be, though I have no evidence to say it's true, that it could be important for mapping onto the ganglion cells. But there's plenty of other theories that say they do other things.
But the cells are just sorting themselves out.
Right. The other idea is that these guys, early in the, there's cell migration. So let's say if you're a receptor-bearing cell and you migrated into the wrong part of the retina during development, you might get pushed back. And so this could also help set up the gradients in the first place. Exactly.
Is it known whether these cells are able to detect a local gradient in a small... few cell region, or do they actually map? They detect that they're in a gradient by some kind of memory where they propagating through the gradient, and they realize this region's stronger than this one over some period of...
Right. So I guess the idea is both temporal and nasal axons early in development, if we'll just look at here, they'll project to the high end of the gradient. And then the temporal guys get retracted and pruned. Okay.
So they're basically seeing the whole gradient.
So they see the gradient, but the level or absolute, like the slope of the gradient, isn't important. It's something about the relative levels of what one neuron sees compared to somebody else. And I'll get into that. I think that has to do with the type of a second non-efferent dependent mechanism of axon competition.
How do they know they're in a gradient, I guess, is the question.
Okay, so they send out an axon, and this axon will see the whole gradient. And then what they're doing is deciding where to branch. And somehow they're integrating, somehow they're prevented from branching more anterior than they should, and they're prevented from more posterior.
So it's very important to emphasize in this literature, depending on the size of the target relative to the growth, there's a whole literature about whether this is targeting by the end of the axon sensing something,
yes,
the growth cone, or, but in the case, even in those cases where that's happening, the growth cone is actually huge relative to the full size of the target. So the growth cone is acting like a big axon. It's actually sampling, in a lot of those species, a large chunk of the target. In mice and in chick, the growth cone is small relative to the target, so what you do is you extend the long axon shaft, which is stretched over the entire target, temporal structures. Then you send that branch, so basically the entire initial axon is acting like a growth cone. So basically one cell is sampling the entire, or is seeing the entire.
As to calculate the difference, sense the difference in number of molecules between front and back. So what are these numbers? Do you know?
Well, Greg calculated there's three times more the absolute numbers.
Yeah.
And I'll show you, I don't think the absolute numbers matter, right? It's relative.
In terms of noise, they matter a lot.
Sure, there might be some...
It takes a long time. I mean, what we think is happening is basically the cell is constantly trying. And so it's not the ability of one cell to sense the gradient. It's what that cell is doing relative to all of its neighbors, right? So what we actually think is happening, and I don't want to take too much time, is basically if two cells have different levels of EPH receptors, for example, they're going to control where they branch, all right? And remember, as David pointed out, the EPH receptors are negative things. They're preventing branches from happening. There's a countervailing force, which Dusana studies, which is another receptor, which is pulling the branches out in the first place. And so that whole process is being integrated over time. So it's not like one cell has to do a calculation, it's constantly trying. And it eventually loses relative to a stronger cell.
Right. I mean, we'll get into this more, but I mean, if you're the postsynaptic neuron and the colliculus, it seems to say it only wants to make four synapses. And let's say there's four axons trying to get at it. This guy, the ones that are most bothered by the efferent expression on the cell will lose compared to the ones that are least bothered by it. So it doesn't really matter how much they have or how much it has. It's relative to the guys trying to get at this guy and form a synapse. Who's least bothered? That's one way I think about it. And that way, it doesn't matter about the level. It's just relative level. Right, okay. Okay, so I just told you a bunch. So now the basic question is what I told you at all true?
Question. So is it at all clear why the axon grows up to the envelope?
Is it clear to me? No. I mean, some people will argue, as you're aware, that there's an attractive... Well, there are other people, and we'll go through different models, that there's different... One is maybe axons are attracted to efferents at some level. You know, you love the one you hate or something, right? So you want to go there, but then you get there and you didn't like it, right? So it's some sort of attractant mechanism. Other ideas is why do axons go to the posterior in the first place? There's either efferent-dependent explanations or efferent-independent.
Well,
of why an axon prefers to grow straight. In culture, an axon will just want to grow.
Right. Actually, there's something pulling out. It's not because they're growing up the gradient, but the gradient is basically irrelevant at that point. The only place David actually has data for, right?
So why is it irrelevant?
Because they don't pay attention to the gradient. They go all the way.
So why don't they?
Well, I don't. Yeah, yeah. Why? Well, we need our regulate. Where's our messenger RNA guy?
They play attention. I think this is your data, right? Is when in the ligand knockouts, you do actually see a phenotype in terms of growth initially. So that when you move from the superior to the inferior colliculus, there's a big step.
They'll overshoot. Right.
So the gradient goes like this, and then it goes boom, right? But when you take that step function out, now the axons not only grow up the gradient, they keep on growing, they grow past the end. So that's the really only thing they respect in terms of the initial growth. It's like they don't, the only thing this gradient is important for is the branching, not for the initial growth. Right. And as a general concept, people have to keep this in mind, right? It's like these gradients don't have anything to do with getting the axons into the target. That's controlled by other axon guides. So only when they get to the target, then they got to do something, got to make synapses. That's where.
No, I don't really understand. I mean, your point, because in striped assays, right? This is the same tissue, which is the only difference. It was chopped, right? It's the same tissue.
You know what I say to the striped? I say fat to the striped assays. You know, they're basically those striped assays. They make the important that David made, which is that these things act as chemocons. You try to do anything more with that, it's nothing. So first of all, what you have in the striped assays, you have all their known discontinuities. So you're asking the axon to make a yes/no choice. Do I want to go here? Do I not want to go here? It's a completely different situation.
But the effect is qualitatively different. In one case, it's of repulsion, and another one of repulsion.
But you haven't given them a gradient. If you just presented a smooth gradient and you put a stripe there, these guys would probably go right.
But it's weird. It's the choice. If you give them a uniform stripes where everybody's expressing FRNA, they will grow.
Absolutely.
Right.
But they still grow there.
Well, they don't grow, depending on the concentration you use. Sometimes they grow better.
They still
stop. Yeah. I know, but again, that's a completely...
Okay, but anyway, right. So the simple answer is I don't know exactly what's different between an E16 retinal ganglion cell in vivo versus in vitro via its efferent sensitivity. But like you said, they're sensitive in vitro, and they're not as sensitive in vivo.
Well, they actually have opposite effect. I mean, they grow.
They
grow up the gradient.
No. Right, but whether it's the gradient they're growing up or some other thing they're growing, we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I agree with you. I don't know.
The same thing is present in assays, in striped assays, right?
Well, there's gradient assays that people have tried, and we've tried in our lab, where you ask them to grow on a gradient, and in some case, some experiments, they'll grow into a gradient and stop at a certain place in that gradient. And that place they stop in the gradient is positionally dependent. Other assays, it's not quite, but there's maybe only half temporal and versus half nasal that stop at different places. It's not like you get continuum independent stoppages. So my feeling is the postsynaptic cell has a lot to do with these decisions, and I'll show you data why I think that. Okay. All right, so what I'm going to show you, a series of experiments where we just want to say, okay, if all this is true, let's take them away from the mouse, see if they have mapping defects, see if we can interpret these mapping defects into and help us build models for how these maps form by loss of function analysis, okay? And then we can learn what efferents do and what efferents don't do at the same time. Okay, so we're going to show you different kinds of ways we analyze these mice. So we made knockout mice where we take away efferents, and I'll show you efferent A2, A3, A5 triple mutant mice. These mice can be viable, not all of them are, but they can grow up to be viable and fertile. Okay, and I'll show you they have pretty good mapping. One way we do this is what we call anatomical tracing. So we can inject the eye, like Greg did, into subsets of retinal ganglion cells. We can trace their projections to the LGN. LGN is three-dimensional, so a single retinal injection will give a column in the LGN. This is depicted as a series of sections. Or into the colliculus and four puncta. So I call these the dye eye. The fluorescent dye gets taken up, and where the synapses are, or the terminations are, you get a lot brighter puncta. There's a lot more membrane here, so it's brighter. So these are the termination zones. And you can see there's this nice map, the nasal side map to the posterior colliculus and the temporal side.
Does that column in the LGN relate to the different kinds of ganglion cells?
I can't say for sure, but I would like to think that.
Okay,
definitely. It's crossed my mind. I have no hard data. Okay, so so we just ask in mutants then, you know, do these go to different places than they do in wild type? And I'll just show you some of these type of experiments. So here's on the top two wild type mice versus two triple efferent mutant mice. Single injection into the retina there. You know, in wild type mice will always give an anterior lateral termination. Same injection of triple mutant, you'll see some axons go too far. So this is the posterior anterior. So the efferent gradient is up and down, high to low. And this makes sense. Temporal axons have high receptor. They get easily repelled. You take away the repellents, they can go further. So that seems straightforward.
But why is it localized?
Yes.
Why do you get terminations? I'll explain all that in a second. Well, the short answer is because there's other things besides efferents that localize them. Okay. Now, the nasal axis, an injection into the other side of the retina will give you a spot in the posterior. And if you take away efferents, you get these ectopic terminations in the wrong places. This, as I'll talk more about this, this doesn't make sense by strict removal of a repellent. Nasal axons already didn't care about the efferent repellent activity. There's high levels of efferent here. You take away the repellent activity, why would they start messing up? Okay? That's the first question we have. I'll get to that question in a second. This is a complicated slide to show you the LGN. It's also true. Efferents are important in retinal geniculate mapping. What you have to do is do a series. These are a series of LGN sections, so if you stack these on top of each other, you'd have a three-dimensional LGN. A single injection will have a termination in a couple of different sections. And in red are three different, or five different animals, I forget the number. And you see every spot is where we mapped a termination. In an efferent triple mutant, you see spots as well. They're slightly in more sections usually, and they're not always in the same places as the wild type. And we've done this from every part of the four different quadrants of the retina, and we see similar things. So there's mapping errors in the LGN. It's harder to see and it's harder to quantitate, but they're different. And if we do the same thing in the cortex, now instead of injecting dye into the retina and seeing where they go, we do what we call retrograde labeling, where we inject into the cortex and trace back to the cell bodies in the LGN. Okay, so in this case, two injections next to each other in the cortex will trace cell bodies from cells that projected there, and those cell bodies would be clustered separately from each other. If we take away efferents and we do this retrograde analysis, we get the next slide. Oh, so here's three different sections from the same mouse in wild type. And in triple mutants, we see intermixing. Although if you notice in this particular example, the red is kind of clustered more than the green. So we don't get a complete intermixing. Okay, so all this is saying, those three slides, is that efferents are required for mapping in every visual area by anatomical tracing. So the next question we had is, are these axons that are in the wrong place functional? Or do they get silenced? Can the brain know to quiet them because they're in the wrong place? And so we hooked up with Michael Stryker's lab at UCSF, who his postdoc Valerie Kolatsky, who was here a couple weeks ago,
last week,
invented this new paradigm for doing functional imaging. And Valerie can tell you how it works much better than I ever could. But the idea is that when a neuron fires, it uses up ATP that needs to get replenished, which you need oxygen to replenish it, and then hemoglobin becomes deoxygenated to deoxyhemoglobin, which has a different light reflectance than hemoglobin. Tell me if I'm wrong. Anyone knows this technique better? So the idea, for our purposes, is the more active areas absorb more light. Okay, and the other important thing is it's not a single neuron we're looking at. We're looking at groups of peak response, okay, because it's an indirect measurement. But it's amazing. So you have an anesthetized mouse staring at a computer monitor. You have a bar in a certain position. Every neuron that fired when the bar was there, you'll color yellow. As you move the bar over, you can change the color coding. Okay, and you know this within 10 minutes, you get these beautiful maps. And Valerie... Valerie did this for visual cortical mapping.
Just to remind people, if they want to go back and the advice of Valerie said, he's talking
about... Right, so if you want to learn all about the hemoglobin dynamics and the computer programming and Fourier analysis, and those are things I can't explain. But Valerie has already explained it to you. Right, so he originally did this for the visual cortex, which is nice because it's very accessible. It's right on the surface of the brain. You don't even have to remove the skull for this if you don't want to. You can image right through a thin skull. And then I did, together with another postdoc in the Stryker lab, Jinhua Kang, modified this for superior collicular mapping as well. And in this case, we anesthetize the mouse, we image V1, we aspirate off cortex, and then we image SC, which is just underlying the cortex. So we can do both maps in the same mouse, which you'll see helps us do really cool things. So here's the collicular maps, and this is what Greg was trying to describe by this nice phase progression. So here's the dorsal ventral axis, so when the bar is going up and down, you see the response goes across. Okay, and you get this nice phase progression and the keys here. So the middle is the middle, right? Along the, when the bar is going across the nasal temporal axis, you get this nice phase progression along the other axis. So here's our we can separate and look at these each axis separately using this method. And remember, this is functional responses at some level. Okay, so we do this in triple mutants, and here's what we see. You know, wild type is the elevation and azimuth map. Nice phase progression. And the triple knockout mice, the efferent triples, still have dorsal ventral phase progression. And we've done a number of animals, and it's not as good as wild type, but it's not much worse than wild type. But in the colliculus now, what we see is these patches. Is it too light to see? It's a patchy map. Okay, so it's all messed up and it's patchy. So here's red, right? So when that's responding to things in the far temporal visual field hits the nasal retina, which maps to here. And you see there's red patches in different areas. But they're clustered together in patches, okay? It's not an absence of map. And we don't think the colliculus is just messed up because the other axis is pretty normal. So the idea is those ectopic terminations I showed you, you know, you inject the retina, you get these different terminations. One might be in here and one might be in here, but they still are functional and respond to light. Okay? Do you guys see that?
Does that mean that you would expect the unconscious maps to be fine, but the conscious maps to be screwed up? So
I don't think this result. Yeah, you'll see. We'll get there about the comparison of different maps.
The mice would think that they don't see, but they would see something.
It's even more amazing than that. I'll show you. It's even more amazing than that. All right. I hate to say that, but I think it is. So you get a patchy map. Okay, that's the subcortical map. Now, the cortical map of a triple knockout, which we published on, that was unpublished. You're going to see a lot of unpublished stuff. This was published. What we see in wild-type efferent triple mutants is normal phase progression. So the colors still do it, but it's blurry. So instead of a patchy map, we call this a blurry map. Okay, when we just take away efferents. And this could mean that, you know, efferents are more important somehow in the colliculus than in the cortex, or we don't. By itself, it doesn't mean much. It just means they're different. Okay, and while the other axis is normal. And for people who are interested in cortical patterning, the other subtle thing is the tilt of V1 relative to the rest of the midline is slightly off. So somehow efferents may be important in early regionalization of the brain, but not horrible dramatically.
How do we interpret these colors in terms of intensity? Colors labeled type, but not how.
Not intensity. So right, I have data. We can measure pink peak amplitude or total intensity in the different things. We can measure things like map scatter and try to quantitate this. And so yeah, we've done all that. So the maps are, and triple mutants are reasonably same intensity. It's just blurrier, or no more scatter.
Shift into the blue, and the eyes tricked into seeing a lot of yellow. The population of neurons that occupy those colors are the same, basically.
Right. Okay, so just from what I told you, right, so efferents required for mapping in every area, so we easily showed that. The collicular map seems to require efferents more than the geniculate cortical map based on patchiness versus blurriness, if you think of patchiness as more disrupted than blurriness. And one idea of the blurriness is that the axons in the wrong place were silenced somehow or trimmed out. Because by our retrograde analysis, we saw axons going to really wild wrong places. We don't see their function. But even in these triple mutants, and this is especially true in the cortex, but even in the subcortical structures, the green is still on top, and the red is still on the bottom. Okay, so there's something left. Yeah. So we'll get to that in a sec. But I'm going to have a little aside, just on mapping mechanisms in the first place. And this is probably just because Alexi and Alex and Greg are here. To go through some models. So the real question from the first stuff is, why are the nasal axons mismapping, right? If I, just based on repellent activity, one gradient of repellent activity, nasal axons shouldn't care. So why do we see mistakes where nasal axons are stopping short? And we can't explain it just with this kind of receptor gradient and ligand gradient.
Well, I might.
Okay.
I would say they're making mistakes because the temporal axons are making mistakes, and there's only so much room.
Right. But that doesn't—that's not based on repellent act. That's based on a second mechanism.
Well, second mechanism based on the temporal axons losing the repellent.
Okay? Sure.
So okay. The temporal axons aren't responding to the repellent, and now suddenly they start willy-nilly going back to things. Then the nasals who would be, there's no place for them. Right.
Okay. So I got three models, which Greg's is the third. All right. So here's our three models.
I love competition.
Yeah. Okay. So. The basic simple thing is we need a second gradient of something to get those nasal axons. Why do they go to the posterior in a wild-type mouse? So there's three models. One model is from my graduate postdoc advisor, John Flanagan's lab, after I left. They published a paper that suggested that FRNAs are also attractants under some circumstances and repellents. Okay? So in this case, temporal axons go to the anterior because they're repelled, while nasal axons go to the posterior because they're attracted. And if you take away the FRNAs, you're taking away both repellents and the attractants. So now temporal axons can go further because they're no longer repelled. And nasal axons might stop short because they're no longer attracted. Okay? So that could explain it.
But then you would completely lose any kind of structure, right?
Then if that was the only thing going on, then in the absence of FRNs, you would lose everything.
But that's not
what it is. Right. But it would explain at least why FRNs nasal axons stop short.
And why would the same ligand be repellent in one case and attracting in the other? So these axons are not exactly the same?
Well, why? Yeah, how can a single ligand be both an attractant and repellent? So there's different ideas. One idea is that the ligand itself at high concentrations might be in a different multimeric form than at low concentrations. So there's some evidence that clustered ligands have stronger activity than unclustered ligands and things
so
like that.
Right.
Yeah, so that's one idea. Or another idea, which there's no evidence for, is that some of the receptors in the gradients, remember there's multiple, Greg talked about three different receptors expressed in the retina. Some may be repellent receptors and some could be attractant receptors. There's no data for that, but I wouldn't eliminate that as an idea.
Okay. Why couldn't you have just the repellent? It seems like you could have the same effect.
So if it's only repellent, these nasal axons, which go here and aren't repelled, if you took away the repellents, why would they move their mouth? Right. In theory, normally they could go anywhere. They're not repelled from anywhere, but they always go to the same place. So the attractant model explains why they go to the same place and why if you take away an efferent, they would mess up. Okay? So let's get everybody with the first model. The second model takes into this efferent expression in the retina itself. And the receptors that are in the target. Remember, there's really counter gradients in both. And this idea was primarily put forward by this guy, Uwe Drescher, who is in Bonhoeffer's lab, one of the other main lab that studies, the main lab of the discovery, the father of topographic mapping and the co-discoverer of efferents. That's maybe how I would politically say it.
Really very, very.
Well, I never know my audience.
Sparing
I'm on tape here. Right.
So Sparing might take exception.
Sparing might argue with Bon. Okay, so if we want to go through it, we don't need to. Bonhoeffer lab did very important work to establish the asymmetrical distribution of labels in the colliculus or tectum. Sparing came up with the idea, and Flanagan cloned the first efferent as a ligand for the receptor. Bonhoeffer cloned another efferent biochemically, and together they published in the same issue as Cell, I think, that these were expressing gradients and likely to be topographic mapping molecules. Okay, and I'm happy to change my...
We have two Bonhoeffers in Max Planck Society.
So this is Bonhoeffer the senior, not Tobias. This is his dad. Okay. Bidirectional signaling. Never mind who's... I won't give anybody credit because I don't think it's true anyway. All right. Temporal axons have high receptor and they get repelled by the repellents in the target. So temporal axons go to the place for the same reasons as always. Nasal axons here, they express high efferents. There's in vitro assay data that suggests that efferent-bearing axons are repelled by receptor-bearing membrane. So with this... So the idea is that nasal axons get into the target and they get pushed by the back by this repellent receptor in the target. Okay, and this way, if you take away efferents in our mice, now we're taking away efferents, remember, from here and here. It's a complete knockout. And so temporal axons go too far because the repellent activity in the target, and nasal axons stop short because they're no longer repelled by the receptor in the target. It's the second way of thinking about how positional identity can be. Okay?
It seems to contradict the striped assays, right? I know that they've been looking for that.
No. So in the striped assays from in vivo, it contradicts everything but one study, okay, which has never been reproduced. And so, and if we have some Bonhoeffer files, they'll know what I'm talking about. But what Bonhoeffer did is they took posterior half or posterior versus anterior stripes, not even caring about efferents. And they found that temporal axons avoided the posterior, but nasal axons were not attracted to the posterior. They didn't care. So, but that may imply to me that you might need a live postsynaptic cell expressing the receptor rather than just a membrane expressing the receptor. But you could make it fit if you wanted, right? And then the third model is this competition model that Greg proposed based on this beautiful work with the kinase insertion mouse, and is backed up by my knockout data. The idea is that it's about relative level. The idea is that, I guess the simple idea is the target wants to be filled. The axons want to fill the target, okay? And there's something limiting in that target that they need in order to stay alive, okay? Whatever that may be, maybe neurotrophic. So the idea is the temporal axons are forced to this end, right, because they're repelled. The nasal axons could go anywhere, but they'd have to fight the temporal axons for something limiting. And therefore, they switch. They'd rather switch than fight. And so they get pushed to the posterior because that's where there's less competition. It's a razor commercial.
No,
right?
No, it was
cigarettes. Is that what it was? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You'd rather fight than switch.
Lucky strike.
What about the idea of desensitization to a ligand? The idea of desensitization to a ligand, so like the nasal axons are seeing the ligand in the retina. So then
they can't see it in the target. Yeah, no, there's all kinds of complicating reasons, you know, how this model can be changed.
I think that model is pretty much it.
But there's some I don't know. But anyway, the point is, here's the three models. I'll just tell you how I've tested one of them. Okay, we'll just sit, go there. Okay, you guys all understand the three models. I guess that's the key.
Service test, right?
You like it?
Totally
disparate. All right, so here's the idea, right? So there's something limiting in the target, which is cheese in this case. Now, everybody needs some cheese to survive. Nasal axons, and the cheese is presented differentially, right? So nasal axons could reach the cheese anywhere, but the temporal axons can only reach the cheese there. So they're going to grab this and fight for it, or they die. The nasal axons might want that cheese, but they'd rather not fight and take the cheese where they can. You take away the efferents, now you have competition only. Temporal axons might win where the cheese, it's an equal fight everywhere, so sometimes temporal axons will go too far, sometimes nasal axons will be stopping short. Okay? That's the idea. And then, so how have I tested it? So I tried different ways of testing it, but here's what we've decided on. We decided to take away the competition, okay? So what I'm going to show you is what happens when we remove a lot of the ganglion cells from the mouse and ask what happens to the mouse. And there are different predictions. Those three, nothing should happen to the maps in the first two projections as long as the gradients are the same, but in the third we should get mapping errors. So we've been studying this mouse called MAF5. It's a mutant mouse. It's a basic helix loop helix transcription factor in the retina. In the absence of this, you lose most 90% of the retinal ganglion cells. Okay? So they still make ganglion cells. Here's a wild-type retina, and these are the retinal ganglion cell axons leaving the optic nerve, and you see there's a lot less axons in a MAF5 mutant mouse. Here's the ganglion cell layer, and you get a lot less cells in the ganglion cell layer. And people have been studying this as, you know, how to make a retina, right? That's why they studied it.
The receptive field of these retinal ganglion cells are also bigger because there's...
Right, so part of where I got this idea from is Jeremy Nathans? Massland. This guy, Massland at Hopkins, studied what happens to the other side, not the projecting axon, but the dendrites. And what he found is that the dendritic fields got a little bigger, but not as big, so they tiled still. So he was looking at it with how do you regulate the mosaic formation in the retina. And he found it's some of it's intrinsic and some not. So he got kind of a middle answer. And we're asking what happens on the other end.
Yeah, but it might be for the independent pieces of the game.
Right. Well, what I can tell you, because I'm...
Right.
So remember, this all happens before eye opening. And what I'm going to tell you is that they still have spontaneous activity patterns relatively normal in these retinas. And we'll get to that. We may never get there, but let's try. All right. So here's what happens. You fill an eye. So now we can do a whole field. Okay. When you fill a whole eye in wild type, in an adult mouse, you fill the whole target. This is the superior clip. At P2, you fill the whole eye. You practically fill the whole target. There looks like there's a little emptiness at the very posterior. But you see how they all come in full. In a MAS 5 mutant, here's an adult. All the axons pile up at the anterior medial end. Okay. They don't fill the target now. They all like it here better. And you can see this as early as P2. They prefer medial, and they maybe fan out a little bit. And what they'll refine to is this anterior medial. Okay? And indirectly, we've shown, though we can't quantitatively say it's the same, there are still asymmetric gradients of FAs and FRNAs and FBs and FNBs in the mutant retina and in the colliculus. Although the slope of the gradients, we can't compare. But remember, it might not matter, the slope, to some level. Okay, so somewhere I should have a slide. So what we think is going on here, this shows that in the absence of competition, that FRNAs repel everybody. Nobody really likes to be around high FRNAs. They all rather be down here where it's lower. And presumably something along the other axis is putting them here in the same analogous way. And so, in the absence of competition, what we don't know is if this is a topographic map that's compressed, or if it's scrambled. What we would predict is temporal axons would still be stuck here on this end, but the nasal axons would intermix with them. And we're slowly trying to do this. We can't image this mouse functionally because it's not responsive enough yet. So we're going in with single. Yeah, I don't know. There's no MAS 5 in the colliculus yet. We are doing that, but we don't think there's any patterning errors of the colliculus based on FRNA and FRNB.
So I'm trying to look at this. That looks like it may be. So you've got rid of 90% of the cells. Does that look like it's occupying 10 or 15? It's not.
It's a little bigger than you might expect. And actually, I think, you know, you might expect it to still fill the target. In some models, in many models, you would expect this to fill the target.
Unless the efforts really are massively. So,
right.
You know, they really don't like to grow there, and they don't have to because there's only 10% of the number.
Right. And the other thing is they may need to be together for other reasons.
And I think it would, but you could look at this map with diet on it, right?
It's really hard to get a good injection. There's not many ganglion cells. But we're trying retrograde labeling. But what we've decided is we're just going to record and not worry about technical issues with the anatomy.
So what about behavior?
A blind mice look normal. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we'll get to behavior later. But anyway, so that's my little aside on why nasal axons mismap in FRNs. I'm throwing it out there, competition seems to be really important, and you may not need any other explanation but FRN repellent activity plus competition.
Yeah, I've based on
first
principles, you never need them.
Right. Greg is going to be recommended as a reviewer. Actually, he won't, because he would say, I already knew the answer. Why did you bother? Why bother to do all this work? You could have just called me up. Okay. All right, so that's a side one. Two, then, is remember what's remaining in the FRN mutants. Okay, they still had some normalcy. And the idea and the hypothesis, which we've batted around a little bit, is that it's the neural activity-dependent mechanism. Okay, and they cooperate somehow with FRNAs. And remember, maps are formed before eye opening. Early in development, it's been reported, and I'll show you that lots of data about this, that there's the spontaneous activity in the retina, and they're in the form of retinal waves. And I see Jay's here, and he'll help me where I go wrong here in my history lesson. And these retinal waves, and I'll show you movies of them, the idea is that we'll go through it later. Now, these waves require, and require is not the right word, these waves are cholinergic. So acetylcholine is an important neurotransmitter in the retina at this stage in development to propagate these waves. If you take away one of the subunits of the acetylcholine receptor, the structure, I have to be careful now, the normal structure of retinal waves is disrupted. Okay? You can no longer, none of us can any, after I show you what I'm going to show you, you can't say the waves are gone in these mice anymore. Okay, and I'll show you why. Beta 2 immune mice, people just looked at that knockout mouse, but remember, efferents are present. So in the presence of efferents, they have defects in mapping at superior colliculus, the lateral geniculus, and in the cortex. And they have very mild defects in that the terminations are a little more broad. I'll show you pictures of that. And the maps are slightly more blurry functionally. And the receptive field sizes in the colliculus are about twice the size. Okay, so it's not as good. And the idea is that somehow these waves are important for the final refinement. Okay, and a whole bunch of groups have backed this up. Okay, so let me show you what these waves are. Now this, here's where the physicists come in. What these guys do, and at UC Santa Cruz, we have this place called Santa Cruz Institute of Particle Physics. And there's some physicists there, this guy called Alan Licky, who he lives in CERN, and he's working on the ATLAS project, which I'm not sure, who knows, maybe the physicists know what that means. And they're looking for the Higgs boson, literally, some collider, important particle. Where are my physicists to help me out? Something really important, because they spent 14 years building a giant accelerator in Switzerland underneath Geneva to see it.
Have the people who will be the scientists.
They may know these guys.
Know about that.
Right, right. So like every good physicist, while they're waiting for something to do, they want to study something more trivial and approachable, so they want to...
There are like three programs here, anticipating what's going to happen when the experiment's actually...
Yeah, but the other program now is that it's an LHC program.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, these guys, one of their technical abilities is to build silicon-based detectors for particles. And so they applied this to the building of multi-electrode arrays. Don't ask me how it applies. But they decided to do this. So each of these numbers is an electrode. So this is an array that's like a bed of nails, where each of these red numbers is a nail. That's an extracellular recording electrode. And there's 512 of them spaced 60 microns apart. And if you talk to a physicist, nothing technically is important unless it's an order of magnitude better detection, right? So if you go from a 10x microscope lens to a 100x microscope lens, you'll see a lot more. So these guys went, the traditional, I think, is a 64 electrode array, and these guys made it 500, so almost an order of magnitude, okay? And you get a ton of information from any single recording. You can identify something like 400 to 500 individual neurons per two-hour run, okay? So what I'm going to show you is the movie of what a retinal wave looks like, sped up four times. Each circle is the electrode recording, detecting an action potential. The color, the darker the color would be the frequency of the burst of action potentials, and the size would be the amplitude. This is raw data from the recording. They can do neuron finding software, and they can find individual neurons, by somehow triangulating between all these electrodes, some physics math way. Okay, but let me just show you what the waves look like. This is sped up four times, and you'll see these waves of activity. And of course, we didn't discover this. This has been known for a long time that there are these retinal waves. And you'll see there's silence for a while, and then you'll get a wave come through.
What are those colors again?
The colors is the frequency. So when a neuron fires, it fires in a burst. So it's related to the size of the burst.
And this light being exposed to this retina?
No, this is, okay, so this is a P6 retina. The photoreceptors haven't fully developed yet, so it's the only photo response we see is from these intrinsic photoreceptive melanopsin cells. It's the only light responses. So we don't even have to do this in the dark, and it works good. So if you see here's a wave in time, these four shots, the idea is that these neurons are firing at the same time as each other, and the neurons further away from them aren't, and something about firing together is helping them wire together. Right.
So these are lateral connections
now? No, yeah, so these ganglion cells, so there's an inner neuron called amacrine cells in the retina. They're bursting in a cholinergic dependent way, and they feed into ganglion cells. Ganglion cells are also gap junctioned with each other and can share currents. Okay, so it seems predominantly an inner neuron driven process. Here's a raster plot, so each neuron, each column this way is a different individually found neuron. And you can see, although they're not related to each other spatially exactly, but you can see they tend to fire together, silent together, fire together, silent together. Okay. And just as an aside, we can do light responsive stuff in these retinas now. So we can take an adult retina, put it on this array, shine through a video monitor, give it white noise stimulation or drifting bar stimulation, all these stimulations, and do spike triggered averaging to find the neurons and ask what made it spike. And it's so cool. You can even see, here's the what we call the electrical physiological image. So you can see actually based on the waveforms detected, you can see the cell soma and the axons of all the ganglion cells you find. And they all, it's really cool, the axons, right, they all go out the same way. So you can actually see individual neurons firing in real time by its electrophysiological image. And here is we've started to classify the RGC subtypes in the retina. We didn't talk about this. There's predicted to be maybe 20 different subtypes that respond to stimuli in different ways. And they, each subtype forms a mosaic in the visual field. So a single unit in space will only trigger one of that subtype, but not its neighbor. And so each ganglion cell is monitoring a unique part of space. And you see we can separate these cells based on their spike-triggered average profiles. And we can classify ons and offs. And we're starting to classify all the different subtypes in the retina physiologically. And then we would like to merge this with either morphological or expression profile imaging to try to figure out what each cell type is and what made it a particular cell type, and if it's developmental profiles and things like that.
So that's back to that average of the potential from the electrode.
From the electrode.
It's not the stimulus.
In this case, there's a video. No, the waves there isn't. For this, there is a video, a movie being played, shined onto the retina, and we're spike triggering at.
Okay, so that's.
That's what this is. The waves aren't, but this is spike triggered avenue.
Yeah,
so this has nothing to do with mapping. This is just like cool technology. Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the beta 2 mutant, and here's where it gets a little messy. For years, people have said the beta 2 mutant has no retinal waves. Okay, and let me show you.
Oh, you're talking about this
for
decades.
From years.
A few years ago.
No, Feller, Wong, and Schatz. What's the first wave? Penn and Schatz. No, Penn and Schatz would be 96.
Yeah. The beta 2 mutants.
Okay, the beta 2 mutants came out.
But the cholinergic dependence is.
Yeah. In any case, here's what people have been saying, and here's why. Here's a retina recording in the waves, spontaneous activity, and you see plenty of activity, but you never see waves. Okay, so that's why people have used this as a waveless mouse paradigm. Then, at the most recent neuroscience meeting in San Diego, a guy called Leo Chalupa, who's a scientist at Davis, had this big poster. It said, beta 2 mutants do have waves. Everybody's data in the field is wrong somehow or misinterpreted. And it turns out, and here's what he saw, and we've reproduced this on our array. So now, the only difference is we've raised the temperature from 32 to 37 degrees during the recording. Okay? So you get a lot more activity, and then you get these giant waves.
But what's the normal temperature of a mouse,
37? Nobody ever stuck an electrode in a mouse's retina, as far as I could tell, but they're mammals. They're warm-blooded.
The entire business comes from Italy.
Well, Marfei is the only one to in vivo record waves, ever, right? But he didn't do it in a beta 2 mouse.
Yeah.
Maybe not ever, but he's the only one.
What do you expect to be the right temperature?
I expect the mammals to be 98.6, so 37. So I guess it seems reasonable to think this is the more relevant temperature. Okay, and here's, you can see you can record for a couple hours at lower temperature and then raise the temperature and it starts the wave. So we don't know why. One possibility is these gap junctions between the open up somehow at 37 a little better, and the current. So in our case, though, these waves aren't normal. So from what I really want to make the point here is that this beta 2 mutant mouse has altered, has the structure of the waves is altered. And here's one way we can calculate a correlation index versus distance. So this is the idea of firing together, wiring together. Wild type at low or high temperature, black or gray, are about the same. Neurons really close to each other, about 10 times more correlated in their firing. And as you go some distance away, it drops down to 1, which is probability alone. At beta 2 at the low temperature, here's the traditional view. No real, maybe correlations at very short distances, which actually people didn't even see until they had these nicer arrays. And then it drops off rapidly. But at 37 degrees, we get a different answer. They're lower, less correlated at short distances, and then they're more correlated. And that's because these waves are bigger, right? So when they fire, everybody seems to fire, a lot more people, more neurons fire together. So we don't know where the meaning is in what I'm going to show you, whether it's the difference here or the difference here.
How big is a retina?
So we're recording from a quarter of the retina at a time.
So that's the full quarter of the retina?
Yeah. They're basically, yeah. This is the scale of our array, the lengthwise scale of our array. Okay. And these are pretty good error bars, because remember, we're looking at, these are three or four different experiments. Each experiment is seeing 400 to 500 neurons at a time.
Yeah, I suppose, but that means you're probably still, your error bars are overlapping for like probably close to 15% of the retina. Why do you put it on a log scale?
Why is correlation on a log scale?
Those are still big differences in which
rows. Which is straight line, man. Which is both exponential.
So yeah, we need to figure out a quantitative. It might have nothing to do with correlation index. Do I have a slide? No. We also have been looking at burst size. So there's also differences in the burst size, the burst rate, the speed of the waves. There's differences.
See, yeah, but it's a real anomaly though, because at short distances there still are fairly substantial, even at the high temperature, right?
Yeah.
There still are fairly short. But then when you have this burst at the high temperature. You can probably call it actually, it's like normal temperature. You have this burst, it's basically boom, the whole red. And what's the time scale for calling something correlated?
In our case, we're bidding at 100 milliseconds, I believe.
But I mean, I think the answer to that is we don't know. I mean, nobody. I mean,
and this may not have anything to do with in vivo.
In this field is trying to figure out
what's the important part of a wave.
I mean, right. What does correlated activity mean exactly? How do the postsynaptic cells read it out? And that will really differentiate between.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bigger problem, I mean, we're running a little longer, but maybe Dave, you could address this issue just for the sort of people in general, right?
Yeah.
Is that, you know, and I remember this is addressed in the paper, but I can't remember. You know, one of the problems with these things is you're focusing on activity in the retina, but you have knocked out the beta 2 subunit every place in the brain. And beta 2 is a major subunit of the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors throughout the brain. In fact, I think it is, do I have this right? I think it's the major subunit. So you've also taken it out, if you're going to look at mapping, you've also taken it out in the SC, you've taken it out in the cortex, you've taken it out everywhere.
Right, so the only arguments against that, which I, of course, had to defend in many reviews of grants and everything, which I can't defend completely, but when we've injected things into the eye that inhibit the acetylcholinergic transmission, we phenocopy many of this, everyone we've looked at of the same.
You put an agonist in, right?
Well, it's an agonist. It's complicated.
So it phenocopies this thing.
In retinal wave recordings, we get similar defects when we add epibetadine than a beta 2 mouse. They're not the same exact wave defects and things. And of course, now we haven't done it at the normal temperature. And so that can phenocopy the in vivo phenotypes to some degree. But that's all I can say. And then I can show you that we are selectively messing up things upon one. It's not the whole brain's not being screwed up. That's the other thing, to our degree. But your point is well taken. It would be nicer and cleaner to have a retinal-specific knockout. And there's retinal-specific chat knockouts and things that can help in the future. Okay, well, anyway, so let's... There's meaning in the waves. I don't know what the meaning is. But when we screw up with the beta 2 subunit, I'll show you what happens, and I'll show you what happens when we take away it and the efferent. Okay. And then if you want another hour, I can tell you something else.
Can you raise the bias in the fridge?
Hmm?
Can you raise the bias in the fridge so that...
Yeah, exactly. That would be the one cool thing, is to raise the mice at lower temperature. Anyway, I think Jay told me once. I think I met Jay once at Cold Spring Harbor, and he told me that he didn't want to be a waveologist anymore. And I understand. I don't really want to be a waveologist. I think it is important though. But okay, so beta 2 heterozygote beta 2 mutant efferent beta 2 combos. This is the anatomical tracing to the subcortical structure. You see, in beta 2 alone, in the presence of efferents, terminations are in the right place. They seem a little more diffuse, both on one end and the other end. Take away efferents in beta 2, it's hard to see. You see a cloud or a comet with a head and a big tail. And on the other axis, the other types of injections, you see these kind of things. So you take away one, you take away the other, you take away both. We get synergistic defects. Okay? Implies they're working together in parallel, not in a linear pathway. If they were in a linear pathway, they each would have the same phenotype, or in a double mutant should have the same as the strongest of the three, according to my genetics background. All right, so in the cortex, we do the same thing, the retrograde labeling, cortex to LGN. I'll spare you the LGN alone. Wild type, beta, effort mutant, beta 2 het, little mixing, triple, total mixing. Okay. By functional analysis, and here's the colliculus, is that right? SC. DV map, wild type, efferent beta 2 combo, nasal temporal map, wild type, destroyed. Remember, this was the patchy map. So now those patches dissolve, and in the colliculus, and it's reasonably absent. If you look very carefully, there's still some structure here. Now the cortex, efferent mutant, barely messed up, a little blurry. Cortex, efferent beta 2 heterozygote, efferent mutant, efferent mutant, beta 2 combo, two different mice. Each time, just the nasal temporal map gone, dorsal ventral map, pretty normal. So functionally, you take away both, you're screwed up.
Can you say anything about the DV map? Does the DV map look normal relative to wild type, or is it always a little blurry?
So yeah, so we've been quantifying all this. So the DV map in a beta 2 mutant alone is a little blurry along both axes, but for reasons nobody seems to understand yet. The nasal temporal axis is more affected in a beta 2 single mutant than the nasal. The nasal temporal axis is affected more slightly than the DV axis.
Is the nasal temporal axis longer in cortex than the DV axis?
I'm not sure.
Because it's longer in the SC. If it's longer, it's going to look a little better.
Right. Yeah, so some ideas, and I think these beta 2, in the waves at 37 in the beta 2 mutants, the waves tend to be in a preferred direction. So it could be an explanation. But I haven't quantified that.
So where are the blue and red neurons in the central bottom block? Central bottom?
Bottom.
They're
that's the nasal temporal. The whole map along the nasal temporal axis is messed up.
Right, but there are no blue and red neurons there.
It's not the neurons, it's where they are located.
It's what
the blue and red areas are not represented in this map.
Well, the
blue and red areas, nothing's represented in this map. It's kind of this
only,
is
only the green and the yellow.
Oh, I see. Why is the color of the background that
so
color?
There's so much yellow but then green, but there's
yeah. No, so I think yellow isn't a color. If you look, the yellow is just the edges, which is outside. So I think yellow. This is just some random background color.
There's a little bit of border there.
And we've done very short bar. These are long bar simulations. And in the cortical paper, which just came out, you'll see if we do short bar simulations, there is some slight map.
Well, but according to this map, there are no neurons there at all.
Right.
Right. No,
exactly.
Neurons, they don't grow there.
But according to this map, they're there. So what happened?
No, it's the map. So it's a topography. All right. It's all screwed up. The color is not going to give you any information. All right. It's not
the there's no preferred color. So each neuron is there, but
ugly brownish green.
Remember, this is peak response of multiple neurons. So that would say that there's no group of neurons that all respond to the same place.
But there is no spatial distribution.
Okay.
Where the bar is.
Yeah, the most amazing thing is that this is completely gone.
Right. And here's a receptive field mapping now of individual neurons. Okay, and you see in wild type, this is from V1, you get a lot of these circular type receptive fields, and they're elongated preferentially along the nasal temporal axis. So this implies even at the level of a single neuron, it's being innervated by multiple, in this case, geniculate neurons from that are sensing disparate areas of the visual field.
Okay.
So that's in the cortex, that one. Okay, so here's what we think the mouse sees.
Multiple geniculate neurons, or are the geniculate neurons getting multiple innervation from retina?
Right, so it's complicated. So the retina to geniculate map is messed up, and then it's messed up in geniculate cortex. And it's hard to compare.
Is it the difference of those activity maps to...
Right, so you could imagine the retinal geniculate map is messed up, but then everything's transferred normally and stays messed up. Our labeling analysis suggested when we're just isolating by tracing that projection, it looks messed up. And we can try to calculate, does it get screwed up progressively worse as you go through the pathway? And of course, these numbers are somewhat hard to back up, but we think it is.
It should be.
it should be, and we think it is. Okay, so here's what we think this mouse, right? The DV axis is pretty normal, but the nasal temporal axis is a big blur. All right, and I don't know, we could stop now, but I could just show you one really cool thing at the end if you want. It'll take me 5 minutes. Okay.
Okay, let's have 5 minutes without interruptions.
Yeah, 5 minutes without interruptions. So now I just want to poke it. So you have topic of magnitude. The real question, and I never heard a good explanation, maybe Alex has a good explanation, is why? Why have to pop topographic maps in the first place? Who really cares? As long as the same neuron, you know, when you get the same stimulus over and over again, you hit the right muscle output, what's it really matter, the order? And so one idea we thought of is maybe this order has to do with integration of multiple areas together. So I told you, remember, V1 projects back to the SC, and a deeper layer just underneath, and I'll show you pictures, the retinal recipient layer, and it aligns the visual field. So the temporal axon response stays aligned, right? This way, V1. And I showed you a map where V1 and an effort mutant map was blurry, and the SC map was patchy. How does the mouse deal with this, right? That's the question. Does it figure out how to align them, or is it a misaligned mouse? And so we figured out how to trace this projection. This is quick. You just inject dye into the cortex, and you can trace it into the colliculus. Here's the anterior posterior axis. You see, single injection will give a single spot. And if we move the injection site over in V1 from medial, central, and lateral, we see this spot move over. So we have this nice map that we can trace by anatomy. Here's when we fill the contralateral eye with dye, and we trace the inject in V1, and you see it's the V1 collicular map projects just below the retinal recipient layer. And there's some little overlap in the terminations. So they're in the right place to be talking to each other. Okay, this is, since we talked about this a lot in other contexts, here's the normal development of retinal collicular map, as shown by Robert Hinges and Dennis O'Leary and Greg Lemke's lab, I think. Early, right, all axons project too far in the colliculus, then they start refining and form a termination zone. In the cortical collicular projection, we see a similar thing, but the time, it's delayed a little bit. So by P8, we're still pretty diffuse. By P8, it's pretty fine. So it's possible that this map happens before this map. It's not possible. It is possible. Okay, this map, the cortical collicular map, requires retinal input. In the MAF5 mouse, where there's very few retinal ganglion cells, a single injection of V1 makes a broad but topographically correct termination. This implies retinal input somehow is required for this. And in the beta-2 mutant, we see a similar thing. It implies retinal wave input is important for the refinement of this thing. Okay?
Are they matched? So is the, your projection from the retina to the
colliculus
more anterior than where the cortical?
No, so here's retinal input. That's is the whole eye. And here's a single spot. So yeah, we're not good enough to inject the right part of the retina and the right part of the colliculus.
So in your math in the math mutant, you had that it was the math.
Right, do they match? Right, they tend to match. We haven't done it well enough, but I would say they match. Okay, another thing, you inject V1 in an efferent triple mutant, okay? Now I showed you there were gradients efferents in every visual area. If you inject a single spot in V1, you get multiple terminations in the SC, okay? Same thing. So.
Oh, but what you want to know there?
I'll show you. I know exactly what you want to know. Okay. So now there's two theories. FA, so is the cortical to collicular projection F and efferent gradients just like everything else I showed you? Or is it something else? Okay. And the something else might be matching the retinal collicular map based on green goes to green, blue to blue, red to red, right? Matching activity or just efferent code. You take away efferents, we mess up this map, but remember we mess up the retinal collicular map too, and maybe they're messing up together.
And the retina curriculum, you said, would be already in place.
Would be already in place. Okay, so here's the idea. So we're trying to explain the efferent mutant map. So one idea is a single injection of V1 gets to multiple terminations, but those terminations have nothing to do with where in the visual, nothing to do with matching activity patterns, or a single injection in the red would project to multiple places, but always to red, matching activity patterns. We've tried to do this experiment by imaging anatomy and lining everything up. It's very hard, but this is where my man Greg comes in. And Greg was so generous to send us this mouse. for these purposes. And here's, Greg went through this. It's the knock-in mouse, a single injection in the retina gives you two spots in the SC, right? Because of this receptor level stuff. So then the question is, and then we image this mouse. And here what we see is what sets up the whole thing. So this is functional imaging. And really one of the questions was, is this double map functional in the colliculus that Greg has shown? And here's wild type, you know, elevation azimuth, FRNA3 knock-in mouse, elevation normal, duplicated functional map. Green, green, blue, blue, dark blue, dark blue. You guys see that? Isn't that beautiful? Okay. So
the mouse is seeing, in the SC, it's seeing a double version of everything.
Right. And here's the B1, not a double map. Okay. We don't know why. There's multiple possibilities and we're exploring them all. But we don't know why there's a double map, but there's not. Okay. So now the question really, and this makes it so much easier.
How do you know that there's no double map?
No functional double map.
The imaging doesn't show.
Yeah, okay, let me just...
The imaging doesn't show double map, right?
The imaging doesn't show double map.
That's the difference between the two. Right?
But the imaging is not...
Well, there's...
The imaging is what?
We've done about 5 or 6 in V1. We don't see quantitative differences. Now, we're going to retrograde label from V1 back to LG and ask it. That you could see double map by anatomy. I don't think there's going to be.
But, I mean,
we can look at the retinal geniculate map by dye. We don't think there's a double map in the geniculate. I haven't got enough numbers.
One is he's using the same technique to image the map in both places. One place he sees duplicated, one place he doesn't. The other thing genetically important is the knock-in is specific for the retina. So the only pathway for more perturbing genetically is the retinal collicular projection. So if you're going to duplicate the map again, then you have to reproduce that into the cortex without a direct genetic perturbation.
You could have a retinal genicular map that was duplicated that was simply transferred.
That's transferred.
We don't see it.
So you're saying that in the retinal genicular, we'd see a normal map?
By anatomy, by tracing, I don't have enough ends, and it's not the easiest structure, but I think there's not a double map. We see, let me put it this way, a single injection in the retina gives 2 spots in the SC and 1 spot in the LGN. That's all I know. And I don't know it in enough numbers to publish it. But let's get to the point of now this gives us a beautiful thing. We have a single map and a double map. If F and efferents were the only thing required for the cortical collicular projection, a single injection would be a single injection, and they wouldn't be matched by activity. If the cortex was an amazing and wonderful thing, a single injection would split into two and match the activity pattern. Right? Here's what we see every time. Single injection, wild type, 1 spot, single injection, 2 spots. We haven't matched it with the visual fields yet, with the imaging, to prove they're matching. But it must be because they're projecting two. We do this in the heterozygote mouse that Greg says has a double map on one end and a single map on the other. We have a double map on one end, and 2 spots on one end, injections from one side and 1 spot from the other. So it's fitting beautifully. Oh, this is the pretectal nuclei. This is another visual area that's not this thing. And you can see it in all our, it's there in wild types, and it's a different visual area. So what do we conclude from this? Right, so F effort and signaling neural activity combine. Activity seems to play a stronger role in forebrain than subcortical structures. And here's the idea, the retinal collicular maps are templates used to organize other maps onto the colliculus to integrate what I'm calling conscious vision and reflexive vision. And we think this is going to be true for other places. So if we go back, where's our... Yeah. So remember, S1 also projects to a deeper layer in it.
The colliculus integrates all the...
And we're testing whether S1, a single injection S1, does 2, and, you know, we're going to do...
Well, into motor coordination, Jenny's kind of stuff, this other thing, all these experiments, basically.
Yeah.
If you have a messed up retinal collicular map, it impacts, you know, that the SC is integrating all kinds of... You know, we have this phenomenon of the frog puts his tongue in 180 degrees out of phase when it turns on.
Right. So that's the kind of stuff we're playing with now with these. So we have all these techniques and some mice, and we're just playing with it that way.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be here for the week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of time for people to ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, there's also a projection from the colliculus back to the LGN.
Right.
It's in the superficial tier, which relates to those layers, functional layers, that you were asking about.
Right. So a guy called Pat Levitt, who is at Vanderbilt, had taken FA7, one of the receptor mutants, and traced the cortical thalamic projection, and also found that there were mapping errors in the cortical thalamic projection. So the idea is that these gradients are involved in every projection. And then maybe they help get axons near enough to each other where they can start correlating their activity, and then their activity patterns straighten them out.
Now, what about other thalamic nuclei, say other sensory nuclei? Do they show these gradients, and do their afferents show similar gradients for the receptors?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of amazing tricks people do. So one of them, the auditory nucleus is the MG in the thalamus. It has a nice efferent A5 gradient. And what people have actually done is that Magonca-Sur has severed the normal retinal geniculate projection. Somebody severed? And then he severed the inferior colliculus to MG projection, and now the retinal projection can innervate the MG, but because of the efferent gradient, it would still make a topographic organization. If you did an efferent mutant, it would innervate the MG, but not topographically. So it seems like these are just gradients that are help making axons spread out over their targets. And they're used in hippocampus, olfaction. I don't know if the olfactory guys talked about it. They don't really talk about the efferents, but efferent mutants are also involved in these hemi topographic maps. Instead of gradients in the olfactory epithelium, they're salt and pepper gradients. Somatosensory cortex in our mutants is also messed up. And we've been reluctant to do a lot of learning and behavior assays because of the potential for widespread defects. And we're going back and making better mutant mice, more specific perturbations, so we can start studying that.
So just on the very last piece of data, since it relates to RMSMs, of course, that's the first time I've seen the data. That suggests that, in fact, the cortex is not kicking out one of the duplicated maps. It's integrating the two maps back together.
I would love to find out. So what we're trying to do, we crossed this, just like you sound like you have, we crossed this mouse into the beta 2 mutant mouse. And we're going to ask, does the double map collapse to a single map, or does the single map collapse to a double map? I'm not even sure which way.
We didn't like this mouse by itself, because in the heterozygous map, normal heterozygous, the separation termination zone is too close. So what we've actually started crossing again is a mouse that's heterozygous for the knock-in, heterozygous for FA4 knockout, and homozygous for the beta 2. Because in that mouse, the termination zones are very widely separated, so we don't have to worry about that.
Right. And we love this assay. It's one or two.
It's the same thing for the. I mean, it's like it's fully penetrant. It's not like you have to. It's like every time we do a check, it's very reproducible.
We'd like to say that maybe, reflexive structures are more hardwired, and as you go further and further out, you tend to be more activity dependent.
But so just to understand this, you're collecting information in the cortex from two different spots in the SC. Right? This is a retina.
No, we're injecting one spot into the SC.
Right.
And this SC is normal.
That's
right. And where does it project to? One spot in V1.
No, you're injecting into V1.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And it feeds two places in the SC.
And it feeds two. And this is nothing changed about the cortex potentially. Maybe it hasn't. We can't see it.
There are a lot of studies on the molecular initiation that suggest that the retinal contralateral retinal map actually aligns.
Sure. So there's been plenty of nucleation experiments followed by dye tracing that show that if you take out the eyes, they're more diffused. They're still topographically accurate to some level. But yeah, there's a lot of literature in rats and other things that have shown retinal inputs required for a nice cortical map. So we didn't adjust that part. But we made it, we separated out the reasons.
Time for break.
Thank you.
One, I just thought,